What's up, guys? It's another interview. This week, it's going to be Paul Conway. He is the artist and developer for The Dark Side Detective. His studio is Spooky Doorway. I highly recommend you guys check this game out. If you're not a point-and-click adventure kind of person, that's okay. This is still a good game to start with if you want to break into the genre. I highly recommend it. He's got Season 2 of The Dark Side Detective coming out very soon. I'm excited to play it. Hopefully, you guys will check it out as well. It's nice to meet you. Paul, right?
It is. Yeah, nice to meet you. Yeah, I'm Paul and you're Robert, is that correct?
Yes. So Paul, and you worked on The Dark Side Detective. You were the artist for that, right?
I am. Yeah, I was the artist on that and still am on the sequel.
Okay, yeah, and the sequel coming up. We'll definitely talk about that. Cool. So, you know, this game, I actually played it off the recommendation of another person that I was interviewing, Nathan from Sick Chicken Studios. He made a game called Guard Duty. I interviewed him about that, and he's really into pixel art, and he talked about your game as kind of being very exemplary in pixel art. So, of course, I had to check it out after that, and it does, you know, pixel art. I was kind of introduced after talking to him to this whole world of pixel art and just kind of the beauty of that. But there is something kind of unique and different about the art style in Dark Side Detective.
It's pixel art that breaks a few rules is kind of the best way to consider it. So it's very large, chunky, big pixels rather than sort of a, you know, more detailed pixel art, but I mix it with a lot of like high definition colors and lighting effects on top of it.
Yeah.
Just enough to kind of sell the atmosphere. It was an art style that kind of came about during a game jam.
Mm-hmm.
So the very first iteration of Dark Side was like the first case of the game or a very pared back version of that. And literally the game was called The Dark Side at the time. But because we had very little time to make it, the idea was to figure out an art style that was very quick to do so I could kind of fill out so many rooms and make so many characters. So lower resolution meant less pixels to make. Mm-hmm. So, and then the resolution was so low that the characters didn't even have faces, or just like, you know, flesh colored squares essentially.
Yeah.
And, I just through years of making game graphics, just I knew to throw a couple effects on top of it would suggest some shading and atmosphere. And just the two of them kind of went together really well. And, like immediately, although it wasn't perfect to begin with, it really helped capture the essence of what the game would become.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned the lighting, because that's what really stood out to me. You don't think about lighting in pixel art games usually, but there were a lot of very soft glows, and the whole thing had a very smooth, kind of polished look to it almost. And you're right, atmospheric is a good word for it, because it's a very atmospheric game as well. You know, it's kind of spooky. It deals with a lot of the supernatural. So I think it's the visual is a really good fit for the game, but I really enjoyed it. You know, it's got a lot of pop culture in it. And I was wondering, cause you're from Ireland and a lot of these references, you know, this is a lot of stuff from 80s, 90s. So, you know, if you're a millennial or if you're of the right age, then you get a lot of this humor. But a lot of this humor is stuff that I guess derives from, you know, Hollywood and stuff. Is that kind of the same over there in Ireland? Like growing up, did you guys, you know, was Ghostbusters and X-Files and all these things, like, was that just part of your childhood too?
Yeah, we get a lot of American media over here. So it kind of, all the references we have kind of shows the vintage of everybody who worked on the team. Mm-hmm. No, I'd like to take all the credit for all the references and all the jokes, but like they majority of that is to do with, is Dave, the writer. But like we're all of a similar age, and you know, Twin Peaks and X-Files were definitely influences on us. And yeah, as you say, Ghostbusters and all the kind of, you know, sort of classic kind of popcorn sort of franchises of the States. Like we grew up with them. Like they're, you know, you know, VHS video rental store kind of inspirations. And yeah, it's just a lot of fun for us to play with those. Try to get the balance as well of like what kind of references you can make, like, because if you lean too heavily into them, they exclude a lot of people. Obviously you're of similar age to myself, so you've got like a lot of the jokes, but like some younger players, they may go over their head. So kind of one of the rules of the jokes is that they have to work anyway as a joke, or at the very least not be confusing. And if you get the reference, you know, it hits the funny button.
Yeah. Now, were there any like super deep cuts that I might have missed? You know, sometimes I felt like maybe I'm reading too much into these. Like, I think there was a level in a mall. I think it was one of the extra levels, actually, that was in a mall, maybe not in the first six cases. But I was like, I was, this is probably totally a reach, but I was like, is this kind of a reference to Chopping Mall? I'm like, no, that's way too, nobody knows that movie anymore. But were there any like super deep cuts that you thought maybe people aren't going to pick up on this reference?
There's some references in there which go beyond the kind of 80s, 90s, like kind of American culture references. So, there's one of them that like I think only one person's ever gotten, which is in the library case. There's Aleister Crowley, who's like who's a very famous sort of occultist sort of magician, sort of near the turn of the century, like early 1900s. So he's kind of, I think for a lot of people, he's a well-known kind of spooky character, or at least his name is known. But there's another character there called W.B. Yeats, who's actually a very famous Irish poet. And the thing is that like Yeats was living in over in the UK, in London, I think it was at the time. And the two of both him and Crowley were kind of connected to true and occult society, but they had this grand rivalry at the time, like they were enemies essentially. And so it was one of those things like where the joke, if you get it, is really funny, and if not, it has to work anyway in some way.
Yeah, because in the game they have that rivalry too, but
they do. But you kind of, it just seems like one guy's annoyed at another. But if you know about it, it adds this extra layer to it. I think that's the only one that like nobody really got that I can think of anyway.
Yeah, no, I did not pick up on that one, but I'm glad you explained it to me. That's cool.
Things like them all, though, are all picked out because they're very specifically for US media, like, you know, like having things set in a mall is very American to us.
Yeah.
Like we do have malls here in Ireland, but it's just, it doesn't seem like as big a setting as it seems like in sort of in 80s and 90s, you know, horror movies, as it would be in the States, you know, in the States.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, that new season of Stranger Things where they had the mall, and the mall was kind of like this huge ordeal. And yeah, they were very big in the 80s, but, have you ever been to the United States?
I have. Yeah.
Oh, cool. What parts?
I've been to New York, and I've been to San Francisco and San Jose.
Oh, San Jose. Okay. Yeah. I'm in San Diego, which is not too, well, yeah, it's south of LA basically.
I see. Yeah. I'm usually over the West Coast for GDC, the Game Developer Conference.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
And yeah, so San Francisco for GDC, and San Jose was the 1 year they had GDC there as well. You know, I like the States, but it's kind of just, it's far enough to go that I don't usually get there kind of for vacation.
Yeah, that's a pretty long trip. And, you know, New York, I mean, that's a great spot to visit. San Francisco, a lot of people refer to that as kind of an East Coast city on the West Coast. You know, it's very big. It's cool though. But yeah, if you ever get the chance, man, San Diego is great. We have Comic-Con out here. That's like our big thing every summer, but it's beautiful, beautiful beaches. So you grew up in Ireland your whole life?
Yeah, yeah. So I'm from Dublin, which is the east coast of the island. But I now live in Galway City, which is on the west coast. Kind of after us, next stop is New York, basically, across the Atlantic.
Yeah. And so you started working on games at an early age, or you were just kind of an artist and you got into it, or how did that come about?
So... you know, grew up kind of playing console games, like as a big Nintendo kid. I was one of those kids who was always drawing pictures, always drawing comics. But then one day, something clicked and I actually realized there was art in games. I actually specifically remember the moment was, the game, A Link to the Past on SNES, mm-hmm. the Zelda game. There was this part in the game where you, where you're in a library and you're trying to get this book off the top of a bookshelf. You've got to run into it with these special boots and it knocks it down.
Yeah.
But I couldn't figure it out because I just, you know, hadn't picked up the boots at that point. But normally playing games, it was just kind of this catch-all word. It was like, you know, games had great graphics. But because that type of game in a particular scene, I was stuck and I was just walking around and looking for, you know, a magic pixel to click on or whatever. I just was looking at the art of the scene and I kind of noticed in the book on top of the bookshelf and realized it was made of these little squares, which were the pixels. And then something just clicked in my head that somebody drew that. It wasn't just like the computer is great and the computer makes those graphics automatically, you know, like a make art button was pressed. Like I realized mm-hmm. I could see how somebody drew it. And from that point forward, it's like, oh, I want to be a game artist. And I was fortunate enough to be able to go and, you know, study animation and, you know, 3D graphics and such in a college here in Ireland.
So was pixel art always your preferred style, or are there other styles that you've played with as well?
I've played with a bit of everything, but I've become sort of an accidental pixel artist. So back in the sort of early mid 2000s, when I left college and I was looking for a job in the games industry, there was very few to almost no studios in Ireland. All the work was over in the UK, which has like a very sizable industry. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't keen to move over there. So at that time as well, I don't know if you remember the old Java phones, like the old Nokia 3210s and all
that.
Yeah. They had a very specific kind of small screens and very low powered computers inside them. Mm-hmm. But there was the Java gaming market had sort of kicked off. So a couple of companies were picking up around in Ireland and yeah, all over Europe, but in Ireland there was a couple of them popping up that people were making these games. So I hadn't actually been a proper pixel artist, but I saw somebody was looking for a pixel artist to take over a role to come in as their lead artist. So I kind of learned the basics of pixel art overnight and put together this really quick portfolio in about a day and sent it off. And I got myself an interview. And luckily I got the job and came on board and was their pixel artist for about 2 years there. And I had to correctly learn pixel art after that instead of the thing I kind of, you know, threw together. Mm-hmm. And since then I just kind of, I discovered it and discovered the fun I have with it. I put it down every so often and pick it back up, like, because I've done like lots of vector games, lots of 3D games. But like every so often, my true calling is pixel art, and I go back and I make a new game with it.
Mm-hmm. So Darkside Detective, this is you and like two other people, very small group working on your own game, but you've worked for other people and on other games, right? Like Theme Park and The Sims you've worked on?
Yeah, so... So I worked in, a studio for 2 years and, unfortunately, you know, the companies started to buckle and lose money, mm-hmm. around 2007 or something like that. So I kind of had no choice but to go and like start looking for freelance work. I was kind of still too much of a coward to go to the UK because I kind of still wanted to stick around in Ireland. So I just started freelancing. But I was fortunate enough that like connections I'd made in that job kind of got me other connections in their studios, and I started with like contracts immediately. But I did that work under the name of Doomcube for about 10 more years, and I've worked on about 115, 120 games, something like that. Mostly smartphone games, like iPhone games or old mobile phone games. But some of them, yeah, were lucky ones to get. Like, there was a Sims Java phone game I worked on, which was, it was like Sims World Tour. I worked in theme park iOS. So I kind of done like the 3D rides in that, in, not all of them, but I've done a couple of them. So yeah, it was an interesting, few years kind of jumping between lots of projects. And yeah. I've always liked, short projects. Because I like to, you know, to get in, try something new and get out before I get too bored with it.
Yeah, sample a lot of stuff that way. So do you like the freelance side more? Or do you kind of miss the stability of having the full-time job?
I'm very mixed on that one. so I like freelancing, but I like where I'm at now as I run Spooky Doorway. I'm a business developer and artist for the company. Mm-hmm. And I don't do freelance work. Well, I do the odd small project on the side for people, but I don't full-time do freelance anymore. So I like doing our work, like making our games. Like we're working on Darkseid 2 and another big project at the same time. So I like that, but I'd like the freedom of what we're doing in my own games. But I would like to, I'm always concerned about the money coming in and balance and all that. So sometimes I would like to have the stable job under somebody else. But I'd find it very hard to go back after like almost 15 years, like working sort of freelance or in my own companies. I'd find it very hard to go back and have a boss again or work for a larger company.
Yeah. Yeah, so you had mentioned earlier that Darkseid Detective had started as a game jam project, and I hear about these a lot. I've seen some documentaries where they follow those, and you know, these are a short window of time that you have to create the best game that you possibly can. So I imagine there's a lot of pressure in that limited time. Do you find yourself working better under pressure? Like, does that help your creativity at all?
I think so. Yeah. You know, for any sort of game you're going to release publicly and try to, you know, release like a proper title to kind of generate money and sort of build an audience, your game jam game is not going to do that. But a game jam game, when you're forced to work in 12 or 24 hours to come up with a game, you start very quickly to find the limitations and what you can do within them. And it kind of forces creativity. So you might come up with, you know, as I said, with Darkseid, it was an art style, or it could be just a very quick kind of simple mechanic, and just by forcing you to do it in that time, makes you just get very, just work cleverly and how to find ways to get things done. Also, like if you're working on things in your spare time instead of that kind of compressed time, like you kind of drag it out, it can end up being weeks, and ideas get to evolve and change, sometimes for the better, sometimes for the worse. But if you're forced to put a demo together in you know 12 to 24 hours, like you end up getting very creative and very interesting things done in that time.
Yeah, and you have to put that pressure on yourself sometimes. I'd imagine being your own boss and having your own company, making your own game. But talking about Darkseid Detective, the first one, I do want to talk about the second one that's coming up, but, you know, I play a lot of point and click adventure games, and it's, and very few of them have voice acting. So I'm guessing that's just like with a small team, that's a lot of work, I'm guessing, for voice acting. Is that why you guys decided not to go with that?
No, so we were building the game for a long time without voices in it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's costs associated with getting somebody in to do voices or getting a team of people to do voices. You know, people do work and to do good work, and, you know, they obviously should be paid for their time. Mm-hmm. So when we're working on this game for free in our spare time, it's kind of hard to justify the money. But we got a very small bit of funding in at one point, and we were considering trying to get people in to do voice acting. We even had lots of offers of people just wanting to do it for free. But we did a test at one point. We got this really good voice actor in I can't remember his name offhand, but he did voices for a trailer of the game. And it was really strange. Number one, it changed how we all saw the voices in our heads. Everybody in the team had a different voice for Officer Dooley or Officer McQueen, and to hear somebody do those voices kind of felt very, very strange altogether. Another thing as well we noticed is when we actually tried putting sounds into the game, you kind of read Darkseid at your own pace. So as you're playing it, you may not even realize you're doing it. You're kind of clicking text to kind of finish a line quickly, and you click to the next joke and to the next joke. So it's real snap, snap, snap humor. Like, so it's kind of one of the things that makes Darkseid funny is that it kind of is as fast paced as you want it. But if you're waiting for something that you've read in like 2 seconds to be said over 10 seconds, it drags it down and slows the whole experience down. So we kind of felt really robbed the humor of the game. Like, Darkseid is a short game, but yeah, it actually has a lot of content in it. We had like, I thought it was like 50,000-60,000 words in the game. That was more than Broken Age, which had like a $4 million Kickstarter or something like that. Mm-hmm. And do you have the scenes are in it? Or, sorry, go on.
Oh, I was just going to ask, did you guys do Kickstarter for the first Darkseid Detective?
We didn't, no. Okay. We kind of weren't confident to do it. We probably could have, and probably could have got some small money from it, and we may have benefited from it to kind of just, you know, would it ease some pressures at the time. But we just weren't confident enough that we weren't sure we had the audience, or weren't sure as far as people are concerned, we were unknown. Like, although I'd worked on a lot of games, people didn't know me as an adventure game developer, or Dave or Tracy, who worked on it. Yeah.
But now that you've had the first, or you've had Darkseid Detective, it's done very well. People have really liked it. And you've been really successful with the Kickstarter for season two, it looks like.
Yeah, it was, we were in the good position of having a game already out there that people liked, and having, you know, gathered all the audience on Twitter and Facebook. So we had people we could talk to directly, or people were like, you know, telling us directly on social media, like how much they appreciate the game. So we were in that magical position that we didn't have to try and build an audience to create a Kickstarter. We already had an audience, and then already had an audience who knew we could deliver a game. So we were very confident at that point to try and get some of the budget for season two together through Kickstarter.
Yeah. And you guys have met your goal, and you've actually, exceeded it, and you've hit your first stretch goal. Now, does that add more time that it takes to make the game when you hit those stretch goals? Cause then you promise more content.
Yes, but we're going to do the stretch goal content like we did the bonus cases on season one.
Oh, they're going to come later after release.
Yeah, it's only one case. It's an anthology case where it explores the lives of three other characters in the world of Darkseid. So it's as long as in the regular case, but it's not a series of multiple cases to do.
Yeah. And I was reading, so season two, it sounded like the cases, and when we say cases, just to clarify for people who haven't played the game, so the game is split up into different sections, each section being a case at a different location. But the season two is going to have much longer cases, so I'm assuming it's going to be just a longer game in general?
We think so, yeah. So again, Darkseid is as long or short as a game as quick as you are as a player. Mm-hmm. And how quickly you can read and how quickly you can solve things. But the size of the cases, like the amount of scenes you can go through and the amount of twists and turns are certainly increased in some of them. So mm-hmm. I'd say of the six cases it's launching with, three or four of them are like a case and a half or two case sizes from season one.
Okay. And can we expect Dick Breckman to return in season two?
Yeah, there's a few. Dick Breckman, he's an amazing character. I'd love to take credit, but that's all Dave. Okay. Yeah, but there's a lot of returning characters, and we're trying to balance that as well, because you don't want to have every scene or every joke being somebody from season one. Because we like Darkseid that you are able to jump into any case nearly. So other than the first case where McQueen is in search for Officer Dooley, all jitter cases should be standalone. So we have callbacks, but we try to minimize them. But Dick Brickman, he's a constant.
That's good to hear.
We have a wrestling case, and he's in there at one point.
Oh, he's part. I've seen the screenshots of the second one. It looks like there's something involving a wrestler, something at the carnival with Shingles the Clown. Great name for a clown, by the way.
But, thank you. I'll take credit for that one. That was on.
Oh, that was you. Okay, great. Nice. So, just because you're an artist, that's something that you know very well. Are there any other games out there, pixel art or otherwise, that you're really impressed by the art?
There's tons. You've kind of caught me kind of on the hop here now. I can't really think of any offhand. Guard Duty from Nathan, that was a good game. That was a beautiful game. Star Mazer, which is coming out soon, looks really good. Has some really good graphics in it. Thimbleweed Park, which everyone's played, I'm sure at this point, looks great as well.
And you know, I always say that game for me was just so seminal because it came out, I think, the same year that your game came out. But you know, point and click is a hard thing to sell people on. But Thimbleweed Park was like, oh, thank you know, the genre is still alive because it was a very big, very. You know, it was like it felt like a AAA, just big budget. I don't know. I really enjoyed that one, but yeah, and the art style was great as well.
Yeah, I actually met Mark Ferrari, the lead artist on it. I met him at GDC at one point. Cool. I was showing him screenshots of Darkseid, and he kind of thought what we were doing was cool. It was an odd sort of zeitgeist thing to happen. Like we were kind of working on Darkseid before even the Kickstarter for Thimbleweed Park was announced. Mm-hmm. And thematically, we were kind of doing very similar things of kind of playing things like the X-Files and kind of a spooky kind of setting.
There's very different similarities, but yeah.
On the surface, there's lots of similarities. Yeah. They are point and clicks, but they are very different experiences. So we had a bit of a battle sort of trying to convince some of the audience that it wasn't just a clone of that game. We weren't just trying to kind of hang on their coattails. Like we legitimately were making our game before we even knew about that game. But their game coming out and being similarly themed kind of set us up for, I think, some of our success came from that, because people play Thimbleweed and like, that's great. Now I want to play something else like that. What's like that? And people were discovering our game that way. You know, even Steam was suggesting our game was like that one. The guys working on Thimbleweed, like were kind enough to retweet us. Mr. Gilbert himself, Ron Gilbert, he was like, he was retweeting our stuff at points and when we were launching the game. He even retweeted and the Thimbleweed Park account as well, tweeted about, you know, the season 2 Kickstarter as well, and that kind of got a lot of traffic our way. I think actually that was the thing that kind of got us over the line a bit earlier than expected. We had, you know, so as I said, we had to kind of justify our game was different to their game, but, you know, it was actually very fortunate at the same time.
Yeah. And I think there's a lot of people out there, you know, it's a niche, you know, point and click adventure is not like the biggest genre out there. And I understand that, but the people who do play it, they're very passionate about it. And, you know, when you put the time and effort to do it well, I think they will support you financially.
Yeah. It's a smaller audience, but it's a loyal audience. And I think the audience as well as adventure game players are willing to play lots of adventure games. So you're not necessarily in competition with other developers. Not that you should ever feel like that in any genre, I think people are willing to play as many as possible. So it's not like you have to be the best FPS on the block to kind of, you know, are you Call of Duty or Medal of Honor? You know, it's not like that. It's, you know, you can be. You can be the modest game beside Thimbleweed Park and still have some success.
Yeah. Do you play a lot of point and click adventure games yourself?
I haven't been recently. I've been sort of just looking at other games a lot more. I'm looking at FPS games. I'm working on an FPS kind of a mystery adventure myself at the moment, my spare time. And I tend to play a lot of platformers and shooters and stuff like that with my son on PlayStation. Oddly enough, we do enough with adventure games that I'm kind of just not as excited about playing them in my spare time. Adventure games are kind of, from my perspective, are more fun to make than they are to play these days.
Oh, okay. So when you have free time to play games, are you usually leaning towards like something more first-person shooter or like a strategy or something like that? Any particular titles?
I kind of like first-person shooters because you can kind of jump in and out of them. Mm-hmm. I actively look out shorter games these days, and although first-person shooters tend to be kind of longer campaigns than, you know, 4 or 5 hours, they tend to be, you know, you can get 10, 15 hours out of them. The play cycle is get in, clear a level, and then finish up.
Yeah.
Because I just don't have as much time. Actually, that's even the case system in Darkseid. It comes from that time limitation. Mm-hmm. The older you get, well, that's everybody in team feels. You just don't have the time to put in 100 hours.
I'm right there with you. But that's kind of what I liked about the Darkseid Detective. You split it up into the case files. So I would sit down and it's like reading a chapter, basically. It's like, all right, I'm going to finish this one case, and then I can, you know, that's a stopping point. That's a point where I can jump out.
Yeah, we wanted you to have a win at the end of every place. You know, lots of people played the game straight through in one go, but we know lots of people who played it go over a week or two in the evenings. I even know a couple of people who played it with their, you know, with their spouses or partners and mm-hmm. or even their kids. They were just, you know, they're sitting down and having, instead of watching TV that night, they were playing Darkseid on the Switch on the mm-hmm. television. And, you know, then they had that nice bit at the end where they finished it, and they didn't have to kind of go on or didn't have to worry about remembering anything. It's like next day they could start off fresh, and all they got to remember is Julian McQueen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and that works for a lot of people.
Yeah, that can be. I was just going to say that could be tough. And point-and-click adventure games, you know, you build up such a large inventory. If you ever leave off at some point and return to the game after taking like a week break or something, then it can be difficult to pick up where you left off. But, you know, again, that's what I really liked about Darkseid Detective. You know, you start a case, you finish it, and you start fresh with the next one.
Yeah, a lot of our design philosophy was trying to remove the things which annoyed us about adventure games. So we kind of wanted to keep the pace up, as I was saying earlier on, with the voice acting. Then we had the shorter play sessions with the case system. And even things like the characters not moving around the screen, that makes it quicker. Mm-hmm. Rather than, you know, in a lot of other adventure games, you're on the left-hand side of the screen and you click something on the right. You got to wait 10 seconds for the character to walk over there to tell you it's a lamp before they walk back.
yeah.
So all our design philosophy is to take all the things, get all the things which are in your way of getting to what you really are there for, which is the story. So smooth them off, make it as simple and as intuitive as possible.
Yeah.
So you can get to the game.
Yeah, that's so true that you meant. I didn't even think about that, but the characters, they don't move, and it does speed that up. And that is definitely something that you run into with those point-and-click adventure games, is just the long time it takes for the animations. I remember playing the Deponia games and realizing at some point, oh, I can double-click like the arrow over there, and it'll send me straight into the next scene. I'm like, oh, that's nice. I can kind of skip the animations. But you're exactly right. Like, sometimes it can get a little tedious, and you've definitely shaved that off by just having the characters still.
Yeah, we theorized that if we had walking animations in the game, so the average play length of the game is about 4 to 5 hours, mm-hmm. Maybe even 3.5 for some people. We reckon that we would have had about 15 hours of gameplay just from walking around.
Wow, triple.
Yeah, because there's a lot of content in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I finished in about four and a half hours, like right in there.
You're right on the perfect average. You had enough time to click around, like, get the jokes, you know?
Yeah, exactly. You know, I never want to rush it with a game. I always like try to absorb it, but there are times where it can be a little tedious. You know, I can't blame people when they play some of these old, you know, when I recommend like Day of the Tentacle or Full Throttle or something, and they're, you know, that's those old like 90s LucasArts games. I can understand why people get a little bored with those. I still love them though, and I'm glad they're remastering them. But
yeah, the remastering of of both games looks really good, actually. They look really solid. I haven't picked up any of the remasters. I was a really big fan of Day of the Tentacle, and Full Throttle as well. I love Full Throttle. Mm-hmm. I loved its art style. So it's nice to see that vamped up and sort of made modern, although yeah. I'm still a big fan of the pixel art of the original. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know what's so great about these remasters? What they're doing, with a press of a button, you can switch between the original graphics and the updated graphics. And not only that, they have like this built-in director's commentary, basically, where they have the creators of the game talking about, like, you run into something and then they can talk about what they're thinking when they created this puzzle. They're great. They're even better than when I played them originally because of all the extra stuff they've added. They've done such a great job with them. So I'd highly recommend those if you ever get the chance. I know you don't spend your free time playing adventure games too much, but if you do.
Well, not at the moment, I don't. But yeah, when I get back to adventure games, I definitely should pick them up.
Cool. So if people want to follow you, check out your artwork, where can they do that at?
Best place to kind of follow me these days is on Twitter, at DoomCube, DoomCube. I have a website, DoomCube.com, but I've been so busy I haven't updated in a couple of years. But you can see a list of credits there and some old games.
Okay. Dark Side Detective Season 2 is actually, you guys have a Steam page for that up right now, right?
That's up there now. You can wishlist it now. And we have the Spooky Doorway Discord as well. You want to find out anything about Dark Side, you can go to the website, darksidedetective.com, which should have all the social media links and all the store page links available on it. Or if you want to go directly to them, on social media, you can go to facebook.com/darksidedetective or Twitter, which is @DS_detdetDetective.
Perfect. All right. Well, Paul, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thanks so much for giving us your time.
Thanks for having me, Robert. It's really nice chatting to you.